the dulcet sounds that means it's time for 372 pages we'll never get back. Hello, Connor.
Hey, Mike. There are two new pocket operators they just released. Those are what I used to make that theme song. They released them this week. There's a vocal sampler and a regular sampler. So we might get an updated version of that theme song with some vocoder effects in it.
Wow. I'm looking forward to that. What did you call
They're called pocket operators.
Pocket operators.
They're little digital music devices that are, you know, a little bigger than a credit card, and they've got 16 buttons and... Surprisingly expensive for what they are, but they're fun to mess around with.
Yeah, I had a different vision of what a pocket operator was. Hey-o! Why don't you tell the people what this podcast is? And we said our names, but who are we and all of that?
Yeah,
all of that
so stuff. I'm Connor Listoka, and we are doing 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back, which is started off as a book club about a book that we hadn't read, but we were pretty sure we were going to hate. We did the first season of Ready Player One, which we were pretty sure we were going to hate. And we didn't hate it. We didn't like it, but it was a lot of fun to read. And now we're doing the follow-up to that book, which is Armada by Ernest Cline. His not as well-received follow-up to Ready Player One.
His sophomore effort, yes. And in our pre-episode podcast, we talked about the reviews for that. And sort of baffling that the differences between the two. One, the first one, was praised to the heavens. This one, not so much. And we're going to sort of root out the differences and be your guides through the comparisons between the two.
Yes. What has changed in the author's abilities, or what has changed in the cultural zeitgeist, or what has changed in the junket and bribe money sent out by the publishing house to the reviewers in between these two.
And we'll also ferret out I'm trying to think of an author who did something, made a big, big splash, and then the second book was a complete reversal, just took a different path and baffled his critics. We'll see if he does that in this. Is this going to touch on the same subjects of video games and movies and things from the 80s? Stay tuned, because we're going to find out.
But I thought it would be interesting. I was looking at statistics, and I realized it had pretty much been exactly 3 months between posting the last Ready Player One and then posting last week, which didn't seem that long to me. But that was, that's a quarter of the year. So I was curious to talk about what we had voluntarily read in the meantime during that downtime, just to sort of, obviously we weren't going to sit around and read more trash like this.
You're editorializing too quickly.
Right. But do you want me to go first, or you want to go first?
Go ahead. Yeah. I think this will be good, because then the listener will know what kind of moods we're in and where our heads are with literature as you coast into this, and you can kind of calibrate based on that, right?
Sure. So the first thing I read after this was, we took a trip to Costa Rica right before Christmas. And I was sort of debating whether to read, like a beach reedy type of book. I even was like, maybe should I? There's a new Jurassic Park book that they like found in Michael Crichton's drawer. And I was like, that could be a good
page-turner. Wow.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's one of those things. They did it with Dr. Seuss too, where they're like, yeah, we found this sketch that he did, on the can, and now it's a book. Like,
was it completed by someone else?
Yeah, exactly.
With the assistance of. Okay, I guess.
But I was still like, maybe this would work. But I decided not to do that, and I instead picked up a book called "The Three Body Problem," which I don't know how it came across my radar, but it was pretty much the opposite of that. It's written by a Chinese guy, and it's sort of like a philosophical science fiction book. It involves first contact, essentially, but it has a lot of. It has a simulation that these people have made to try to simulate this world that these aliens live in, and they recruit people to participate in that as a means of engaging them in the efforts to contact these aliens. It was interesting, but it ended sort of very much what's the opposite? Not in media res, but it didn't finish the story. It was setting up a series.
Okay.
Once you've read 500 pages of a Chinese translated sci-fi series with philosophical undertones, you're not necessarily ready to like dive right into the next one.
Well, but there were simulations in it. Were there rigs of any kind?
No. They did. They had an entire like haptic rig.
Oh my god!
I should have written it down because you are in this sort of you're on there. You're playing the game called the three-body problem, which I guess is a physics puzzle about three objects orbiting each other. Anyway, but yeah, you have to put on the VR helmet and sit in the special chair so you're able to feel these heat and from the giant suns that are approaching, or the cold when the suns go behind the planet type of thing.
Wow.
So there were. And then after that, I read The Underground Railroad, which got a lot of press last year by Colson Whitehead, which my mom's book club had read. And again, I just sort of picked up not knowing much about it. And it was a, rather harrowing tale about slavery.
Is it a straight up history, or is it a fictional?
Fiction, and it has some magical realism aspects to it.
Magical realism, hard pass. I have never liked that. I'm sorry to all those Gabriel Garcia Marquez fans and everything. I'm out.
Yeah, there are real trains in the Underground Railroad, and that was really the only aspect. Anyway, you don't want to ruin it for people, but it was, it was good. It was sort of everything you read about stuff like that is always going to be eye opening to the horrors suffered by people during that era. The sort of thing that you just sort of gloss over if you're just reading a history textbook, but I'd recommend it.
All right. So how does that prepare you and or not prepare you? Do you feel that your perspective had to shift from from Ready Player One?
Yeah, I mean, the slaves weren't doing a lot of talk about which fictional blade they would prefer to wield if they ever had the chance out of all of history while they were picking cotton. But I think that book was also pretty popular. I don't know if it was a Oprah pick or if even that's still a thing, but I think that also probably sold a ton of copies. So that sort of gives you hope that something more well-written and serious can still resonate with people.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And so what did you, pick up over the holidays?
I do a lot of my reading on airplanes. Not that I travel a lot, but then when I'm on an airplane and I'm captive and I can do nothing else, I make sure to read the books that, you always say you want to read, but you never read. And so I just have a Kindle stuffed with classics. And so I read 2 Years Before the Mast by Richard Dana, which is a sort of super popular at the time. I think it was pre-Civil War. A guy stows away on a ship, and they a hide ship. They were selling and trading hides, and so they went to California, which at the time it's a fascinating look. It's just like a day-to-day thing of his life on the ship. And
it's real.
It's real. He didn't call it straight up nonfiction. Okay. It was just what it was, but it's very obviously just his day-to-day stuff. He probably fictionalized the names or something of the people that he actually was on the ship with. But it gives you a fascinating picture of early California before human beings were there in great numbers. And it was just the Indians, as they call them, and Mexicans. And there's a lot in it that would be perceived as, I think it would be problematic nowadays.
His descriptions of the people.
However, he was also very generous towards many people. So it's actually very, it's a cool book, but it has a lot of minutiae about being on a ship, which made me that similarity was like, oh God, here comes a list of what.
Nice.
We're pulling the yard arm over the long hard. It's just the jargon is off the charts. But once you get used to it, it's a good read.
And well, you said the same thing about Moby Dick too, in terms of that.
Yeah,
being
exactly.
Books used to just sort of do that for you.
Yeah, everyone knows what I'm talking about here, right? And then I read E.M. Forster's A Room with a View, which was sort of charming and very funny and sly, more than I thought. I thought it would be sort of a boring slog about, oh God, manners of English people at that. But no, it was cool. And then I've read also a Frederick Buechner book. He's sort of a modern C.S. Lewis. I believe he's still alive. He's an old man, but it was a short book. I forget the title of it, but
like
a philosophical tome. He's also sort of a humorous writer too, sort of sly and witty. So I think I'm prepared.
So maybe when people were saying, like, you guys aren't the target audience for this book, that's why you don't appreciate it. Maybe they were actually correct about that sort of thing.
Oh, come on. I think they're right about that. I think we've been up front. Right. But that doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. You read – look, I have a friend who reads he's one of these fast readers. He can read like a book a day, and I just watch him tear through, and he'll read one just awful paperback pulp thing that he picked up in the airport, and then you see him next and he's reading, like, you know, the Cicero or something. It's like, right. You know, he can just do that. So there's no shame in doing the trash thing every now and then. No,
it's, you know, a good page turner is nothing wrong with it, especially when you're not one of those guys. It's, you know, if it's not the one book you're going to read a year, it's perfectly fine.
Exactly. All right.
Although I took this to the coffee shop the other day get out of the house.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I going to do? I'm not going to sit here. You know, I live in a small town, and I frequently run into people I know in the coffee shop. And I didn't want to have any chance of, accidentally engaging with someone who thought I might be, you know, it's a very easy explanation, but it's also a weird explanation that sounds like you could be lying if you're like, no, seriously, I do this podcast. but so I took an old, Moleskine cover and put it on top of that. Yeah, it was like reading a spy behind a newspaper type of thing.
Wow. Yeah, I used to have to buy, you know, for riff tracks and for many things, I'd have to buy or rent terrible movies. And I remember once I went up to the counter, and I've never ever recognized anywhere, you know, this just doesn't happen. I'm not any kind of a, you know, but occasionally at video stores, I'd get recognized and I could get away with it then. But I'd put a stack of just horrible, you know, 80s sci-fi on the counter, and, you know, it was like seven movies high. And I look at the guy and kind of, you know, give him a little wink and go, yeah. I'm doing this project. I got to do this thing. I have to look at these terrible movies. And he just like shakes his head and he puts his hand up. He's like, sir, I don't ask any questions here. I don't even know. I'm like, what? No, please. Yeah. Please let me explain. He's like, no, look, I don't want to hear it. I've heard this all before.
Right. I didn't come from the beaded curtain area of the store. Yeah. Like,
He shamed me. I just sat there silently. All right. So should we dive in?
Yeah. Do you have an initial impression based on whether those reviews were accurate?
I'll give an initial impression. Yeah. I went in, it seemed pretty much the same. You know, it's a kid of the same age. I recognized his tropes. The 80s stuff and 90s, whatever, came hard and fast. And then it kind of just went into a real slog. And we'll get into the details of that.
Yeah. Now, my impression was definitely that it, we sold those other books. We donated them, I guess. So I don't have it anymore. But I was like, I think by this point in Ready Player One, 47 pages in, a lot more had happened. I don't know.
Yeah, stuff happened. It didn't make any sense, and it didn't have any drama, but it had at least you sort of trying
to
puzzle out. Yeah, you had to puzzle out what was happening and what was going on. And this one, nothing happened, really.
Yeah, so it was a lot slower.
He saw a spaceship,
pace.
Right? Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, well, let's get to that spaceship.
All right.
The book starts, and, you know, I was like, all right, let's not be too nitpicky here. Like, let's just get ready. And then in the very beginning, that's the second paragraph, I saw something that was like, all right, well, I got a nitpick here. He's talking yes. about he's sitting in his class and he sees the flying saucer, and he says that the disc streaked toward the distant horizon, which is, you know, I appreciated the clarification, because it could have been like that. The horizon that was just a couple of feet away from him, as opposed to the, so he doesn't need that word distant, but then the next sentence he says it hovered there motionless over the distant tree line for a few seconds. And I had just, having just gone through the process of letting Lauren edit a book I had written, she would be like, oh, you've accidentally used the same word here in two consecutive sentences. Just, you know, change one of them, just do something else. It's just jarring when you read the same thing. So that stuck out to me right away. The first page, just needlessly using a word and then reusing it the next sentence.
Well, and had she read and was editing his book, she would also say the first word is unnecessary. So the repetition of it
right.
is quadruple unnecessary. Stop using that word or learn what it is. You want to know where I first got bumped up against? Was,
sure.
I think it was pretty early on. He refers to his town as Yawnsville, USA. And I just made a note, like, and here's there's a language warning coming up. That's the go fuck a duck sense of humor we've come to love from Ernest right. Cline. What?
Right.
Yawnsville, USA? What are you, Fonzie?
Well, he's talking about his hometown of Beaverton, Oregon, and it sort of, I was like, it reminded me that the Twilight books were set in Forks.
Yeah.
You just have to imagine these, you know, perfectly, I'm sure, fine, small Oregon towns are like, for the love of God, stop setting your garbage, you know, wildly popular books in our towns. Like, people are going to flock to these locations just to take a picture outside of them.
Yeah, so just to set the scene a little wider, yeah, he's sitting in his classroom. He is, what his name? What is his name? Lightman?
Troy Lightman? Or is it, is that what it is? It's Lightman, yeah. And
but
so,
the first
you know,
time they refer to him, they just call him, hey, Lightman, which could be, because you don't know it's a proper name. I'm like, they're calling him Lightman? What is he, like a superhero or something? Lightman?
He's the fighter of the day, man.
yes, exactly.
But no, so like anything in these books, when you come across something like that, it's like I sort of sigh, and you know, eventually we'll look it up, and that's that is the name of Matthew Broderick's character in the '80s classic War Games.
Son of a bitch!
Yes,
it really?
Exactly. Yeah. There was something else like that later when he goes into the video game store and the computers are named something stupid, small berries and
oh yeah, the big, small big berries booty. I refused to look
yeah,
up.
I did too until I reread it to take notes, and that was something from Buckaroo Banzai, just some obscure reference that only your top gunters would get.
Ugh.
Yeah,
all right. I'm already disgusted. Well, actually, I got hung up on. When the spaceship comes in that he sees, and his friends are and the people in his classroom, and there's spit balls flying around and all of this, he refers to the ship as, it looks like it's from this game that he plays all the time, Armada, and it looks like the Sobra Kai Glaive, which
yes.
sounds like something that you know, Jerry Lewis would try to
yes.
say when he
yes,
Sobra Kai Glaive
Glaive.
Which then I looked up, and it's, of course, some mashup of crap that, look, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I was is that a Cobra Kai reference? Like,
yeah, but yeah. Immediately in my head, I was like, all right, are you expecting me to know how to pronounce this immediately? And I said, I'm going to skip it if it comes up again. But then it came up 8 million times. I'm like, all right, yeah. I'm looking it up, damn it.
Well, hopefully we can poison the well by making people think about Jerry Lewis or Professor Frink any time that they read that. Because I think it's going to be coming up a lot.
I think so.
Chapter 3. Yeah, but so he sees the Glaive fighter, and he thinks that he sort of starts listing the various synonyms where he could be crazy, and that's sort of like your Yawnsville, USA. He's like, I was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, man. Cats with serious marble deficiencies. The apple had fallen right next to the crazy tree. But then he speculates that had he been drugged? And he says, no, it's impossible. All I'd eaten that morning was a raw strawberry Pop-Tart I wolfed down on the car on the way to school.
This is funny. These are both notes that I have exactly.
And I think people found different things to object about here. Like, what struck me was the his claim, bold claim, that he had eaten a raw strawberry Pop-Tart, which would make him the only person in history to open up a thing of Pop-Tarts and eat one of them out of there.
To me, it was what hung me up was, does he also call loaves of baked bread raw?
Yes.
Before he makes toast, is like, I'm not eating that shit raw. What are you talking about?
Right. That was what Lauren got hung up on. It was a very odd way to describe that. Because people eat them like that all the time. Like, you know, I think it's probably 50-50.
Yeah. I also, just to go back, I did write down cats with a serious marble deficiency. Is he suddenly Dennis Miller? I honestly read it twice. I'm like, is there a thing where cats need marble, or they are deficient and they go crazy? Like, oh my God, he's using it.
Yeah.
Like, no, a beatnik, like a fake beatnik. What?
Right.
What is this?
Yeah. That was bizarre. But like, what struck me about that, and he does it a couple times, is He says, I was going off the rails on a crazy train, which, like, okay, that's a
straight up reference
from a street extremely popular song. And then he does the thing which strikes me as very much like it happens to you, I'm sure, all the time. But you make a joke online, and then someone will very helpfully add something to it in the comments. Like if you said something like, if you were just like, if there was a story about solar panels, and then you were like, hey, oh, you know, it looks like Rod from Birdemic got a great deal. And then someone would be like, yeah, I guess he was hanging out with his family. And you're like, well, that's, yep.
Yeah, that's
right. That was my joke. But he says, I was going off the rails on a crazy train. I could practically hear Ozzy Osbourne screaming all aboard. And it's like, you're doing it to yourself.
He does it. Yeah. He does it constantly. It's like, it's so weird. He undercuts his own incredibly lame jokes, or he just repeats them to the point where it's like, why did you make the first ref? Are we referencing things? Or are we just like writing down lyrics for stuff? I don't get what he's doing.
He did it to the extreme a bit later, where he's like, what his dad said, what if they're using video games to train us to fight without even knowing it? Like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. When he made Daniel San paint his house, sand his deck, and wax all of his cars. He was training him and he didn't even realize it. Wax on, wax off, but on a global scale.
Exactly. I enjoyed in chapter one here, his teacher, he said, had been rocking the same retro outfit for 45 years, which he said was like, you know, the most cliche, like, black tie, short sleeve shirt, you know.
It was my grandfather's, first job back from World War II. It was how he dressed.
Yeah, but he was rocking that retro outfit for 45 years. So he started out retro somehow. I suppose he walked in and everyone was like, whoa, Dave, pretty retro, dude. I'm gonna stay with this for 45 years.
My favorite thing about the teacher was when he's slapped the spitballs on the guy's head, and the teacher levels a crooked finger at him, which is struck me as like, dude, your teacher is Baba Yaga, or he's exactly. He's warning you not to buy a monkey's paw. Like, it was a very, but yeah, that spitball scene was fairly revolting. Like the bullies have also, you know, again, not changed since Fonzie or the Wonder Years, but he's just this soggy pile of garbage that's, you know, dripping down this guy's head. It was fairly gross.
Yeah, and his language for talking about that annoyed me. He kept talking about that he had a little pile of missiles laid out, like a wet pile of... How old are you? The description was just, it was just off. The whole thing was off about how, you know, he's doing a very, very cliched scene. It seems like it's something from a... I don't even think it would be in a John Hughes movie. I think those are almost too knowing for that kind of thing, but the description of it just is, I don't know, he has no sense of what is in time or anything, you know what I mean? He's making references to, obviously he stays in the lane of video games and everything, but then when he gets out and tries to describe craziness, he's talking about cats and stuff like, and the, you know what I mean, and that spitball scene was like, what are you trying to describe here? He doesn't have the skills to do it, and so it just comes off very sort of gross and flat and weird.
Well, it's super jarring a bit later when he like runs outside, and then he's like, he says, to anyone watching, I must have looked like a complete mental case, or maybe like Don Quixote tilting at a few windmills before he gave him the La Mancha beatdown.
Yeah, I was very excited by that, I have to say, because I assumed, at first I was like, Don Quixote, and then I'm like, oh, there's got to be a video game of that. There's no way he sat down and read that book when he had to watch, The Wonder Years 55 more times or whatever.
Because that comes a page after they've debated, you know, they've spent, 500 word count padding things debating whether Thor's weapon was better or whether, Wonder Woman's lasso. But then he unleashed the choice line. My own personal choice would have been Excalibur, as depicted in the film of the same name.
Yes, because people are unfamiliar with Excalibur unless they talk about it has to be the 70th movie made about Excalibur.
Yes, I guess.
400th book about Excalibur.
It's not even the, right, exactly. The Monty Python is in his wheelhouse, but it was this particular one. But yeah, so he's... they tease sort of that there's something happened with this bully, which I guess is something that we're supposed to wonder what happened between them. But, you know, who cares?
Yeah, he brings it up twice. And I thought, you know, this is at least better restraint than his normal thing where he describes something, you know, like unlike that dark incident in the past. And then you think, oh, well, we'll be getting back to this later. But he usually will go, the dark incident in the past was. But this time he didn't do it. So I don't know. I just want to give the props when they're due. Yeah, when they're due.
All right. Well, but let's take a U-turn from that to something else that I thought was funny in this first chapter was he's seen the flying saucer, and he's just sort of like sitting there going on for a long time about how crazy he feels. But he says that he felt a sudden urge to run out of school, drive home and find it. And so, you know, you pause there and you're like, well, that's crazy. He can't possibly do that. That would take forever. But then the next sentence, it wouldn't take long. My house was only a few minutes away.
Yep. I loved that too.
He's not one of those students that's putting in 2-hour commutes. And then later he says, as he's driving home, he almost ran 2 stop signs during the short drive home. Oh, so he put on his hazard lights and drove the last few miles, which is like,
by the way, he said that when he went home, he hauled ass. And I just make a note, like, keep an eye out. It could be the new get the hell out of Dodge.
Oh, wow. Nice. All right.
I hauled ass. Once again, a phrase used maybe by the guys who used to beat me up in junior high. You better haul ass out of here.
That's sort of the start. It ends. Chapter one ends with him hauling ass home, and he's about to go into the attic. But before we get there, do you want to break for some real or fanfic?
Oh, let's do that. Yes, this is a good place. And now I bet they bitching because my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write about some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction that I'm living on my life. I'm living on my inner vision. Wow, that music means it's time for real or fan fiction.
Very popular segment, which we'll get into afterwards, but it's days may be numbered. We'll have to see. Just it's hard to find fanfic about this book. It's
Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to lie to you. This thing is in jeopardy. Well, let's go through it, and then we'll make our appeal.
All right, I've got two for you. Okay. The first one begins thusly. Then another inspiration struck me. I was still thinking about Nick Cage in Vampire's Kiss and his ridiculous fangs. Who else had fangs and was related to the color blue? Vriska Circuit. And where had she stood or cast a shadow when she visited John's house? Next to the tire swing in front of the Ghostbusters-themed bouncy thing. And 1984 was, of course, when the original Ghostbusters movie had been released.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right. I will. I'll hold my answer and wait for the next sample.
Number two, the EDA has been tracking and profiling you ever since you first played a video game online. That's why I was assigned to watch over you and to help facilitate your training. He grinned. You know, sort of like Obi-Wan watching over Luke when he was growing up on Tatooine. You're a bold-faced liar like Obi-Wan too, I shot back. That's for sure. Ray's smile vanished and his eyes narrowed. And you're being a whiny little bitch just like Luke.
Oh my goodness. it's tough. I recognize some of the, I mean, let's be clear on the rules. Both could be fan fiction. Both could be from the book.
Both could be real, yes.
I'm going to say, and again, it's always flipping a coin. I'm going to say number one is fan fiction. Number two is real.
You are correct.
Ah,
you are correct.
It was because of the EDA, I believe, was here. So not that that's, I mean, well, people use, you know, people take his phrases all the time. So that wasn't the giveaway, but I thought, well, flipping a coin, I'll go with that.
The first one is from a Ready Player One/Homestuck fan fiction.
I
do not know what that.
That
is, but I think that's where Vriska Circuit come from. It's
that irritated me, and I don't even know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't stand out to the point where you immediately are, you know, you wouldn't bet your mortgage on it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well done. all right. The problem is there isn't Armada fan fiction online because of the relative unpopularity of this book compared to Ready Player One, correct?
Yes. There's literally nothing on fanfiction.net. And if you look up all the Ready Player One fan fiction, a lot of it has character names that we recognize, or, you know, references to Gunting or that sort of thing. So it would be too easy to guess when you did that.
Well, how I would like to appeal to our audience to write us fan fiction, but how would we, we're figuring this out on air, how would we structure it so that we could challenge each other if we're both able to look at it? There's got to be a
way. Well, yeah, we'll figure that out. Send it to the 372pages@gmail.com, and we'll figure it out. We can both log into that and look at it. We can leave them unread until we find it. So
we could have someone else disperse them to us. Disinterested third party.
Right. That'll be what we'll do.
Okay. Sounds good.
But yeah, send them in and try and trick us.
All right. Yep. All right. That was real or fan fiction. Should we move on to chapter two?
Yes, let's do it. Chapter two starts with him about to go back into the attic, where he is reluctant to do this. He's talking about how the first time as a 10-year-old he went up into the attic, he felt like Clark Kent looking into his Kryptonian identity, but now he feels like Luke Skywalker, like about to go into a cave with Yoda. I understand, I guess, what he's getting at, but there's no difference in what he's describing to the casual reader there.
No, I wrote this one down because I actually didn't realize, to my detriment, I didn't realize he was talking about that he'd felt like Clark Kent in the past. I thought it was all in the present. But the sentence is actually, I'd felt like a young Clark Kent preparing to finally learn the truth about his origins from the holographic ghost of his long-dead father. But now I was thinking of a young Jedi in training named Luke Skywalker looking into the mouth of that cave on Dagobah. I just wrote down, like, wait, which is now and which one are you thinking of? Like,
it's very convoluted, and it's very – so he felt like one, but now he's – but it's the same action both times.
Yeah, he's just walking up there, so I thought it was the same thing. But I guess that was the past. I was supposed to know that was the past. I don't know.
Right. It's one of six Star Wars references in this first 47 pages, which is, even by his standards, a stunning measure. And that doesn't count what we're about to get to when he does go back to his father's journal. But so he recounts how he went up there as a 10-year-old, which he describes as being during his GARP phase.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was. I didn't even look it up.
There's a book called The World According to GARP.
Oh, I thought it was GURP. I'm sorry. That was part of a list. I'm conflating two things.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I know The World According to GARP, but.
But what does that mean in terms of GARP phase?
I don't know. I read that. I read that when it came out. I don't remember. I don't know.
Well, it's something that a 10-year-old is clearly aware of as he's exploring the attic about his dead father, but he goes up there, or he went up there, and he had found it was like a soothing balm to my soul. He had found some classic arcade and video game ROMs, and he had found a box of role playing game supplements, which were an underrated detail in Ready Player One. People were always perusing through a RPG supplement in H's Hideaway, which I found amusing that those reared their head again. But he had gone up there and shamelessly read through them all, gulping down new details about the man who had sired me, which I thought was sort of a gross way to put it.
That was really gross. That like made me go, ugh. Yeah, it's like stubbing your toe when I read that.
But it wasn't all classic arcade games and RPG supplements. He found some stuff that he found very disturbing. He was disturbed by his father's journals, which he thought were sort of crazy rantings, and he was haunted by the name Phaeton, which was a arcade game his dad had described.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so 10-year-old, you're in fourth grade, and I was like just wondering, what 10-year-old who had just discovered like boxes and boxes of movies and a, you know, collection of every video game that ever existed would possibly give a shit about any of this journal, this list his father had written down? Like, you would be downstairs hooking this up before you would even, like, you're going to go through your father's old notebooks? Like, it made absolutely no sense from the perspective of, you know, I'm trying to remember the stuff that I liked in fourth grade, which was like Vanilla Ice, Mario 3. I had no discernment about quality, obviously, but absolutely no desire to get into the minutia of old notebooks and stuff. It was like, well, let's go play these things.
Hey, but you're not him. Remember, he'd attempted to fill the void created by his absence with data by absorbing every scrap of information about him that I could. Does that sound vaguely familiar at all?
Yes.
Memorizing and making lists and absorbing information?
Yeah. It's the MacGuffin of how you're going to be able to wedge these references in, I guess.
Exactly.
But his father had died before he was born, or like, and it had some something that sounded suspicious.
Here's what he died when he was, I think, pretty young. I think like 3 or something like that. But he says he made a list of this, by the way, of the things that he knew about his father as he was growing up that were told to him by his mother and his eventually his grandparents are mentioned. Number 3 is he died in an on-the-job accident at the local wastewater treatment plant. And number 4, the accident supposedly wasn't his fault. But once my age reached double digits, these vague details were no longer sufficient to satisfy my growing curiosity about him. I love the fact that he died at a wastewater treatment plant was enough to satisfy him as a little kid. Hey, enough. I get it, all right? Yeah, died exactly. At a wastewater treatment plant.
He knew what he was getting into.
Exactly. If I know wastewater treatment plants, and look, I'm 7, so I do. Please, just no need to fill in any more. Maybe when I get older, I'll be interested. But for now, that's good.
Right. But then that thing flips when he's in ten years old, and he's eating a Happy Meal and like playing with the Harry Potter toy that came with it, and something clicks in his head, and he's like, "Wait a second, I need more details about this mysterious circumstance."
When he got sick,
fill up my orange soda, and I'll ponder this some more.
When his figurines of wastewater treatment workers finally no longer could entertain him, he got more inquisitive.
But so we get into something really good here, but right before we do that, there was something else that very much puzzled me, and again, this is probably a reference. But he says, My father had created it over a period of months or years using a variety of pens, pencils, and markers, parentheses, no crayons, thankfully.
Oh, is it a reference or just meaning that insane people, scrawl in crayon or whatever? I don't know.
Yes. I mean, thankfully not his own feces would be something, that I would associate more with insane, like whatever, like slam on crayons.
His previous reference to crazy people with cats with not enough marbles, babe. So I don't think he doesn't really have a grasp on what that means.
Right. Yeah, exactly. He's using, whatever they used to condemn Francis Farmer back in the day. That's still his baseline for crazy.
Right.
But so what his father has written here is a section that I'm sure will become legendary amongst our modern readers. It is the chronology. And it is 4 pages of, a timeline of listing things, listing science fiction movies and video games, essentially.
It is unbelievable. I mean, and there is no, within the list, there is no editorializing.
No. There's like occasionally an exclamation mark that like Return of the Jedi was released, and that's warranted an exclamation mark.
Yeah, I wonder. At first, I was like, "Is that a musical of that movie?" That I think the Abyss had an exclamation point. I'm like, that must be the musical, I guess.
Right. Yeah. It's like how they'll release a movie that's it's not Rocky, it's Rocky Balboa. They just make that slight tweak so you know that it's not the exact same thing.
Yeah, but I was stunned by the fact that there was. Zero editorialized. Simply a list of things that happened in sci-fi.
So, Mike, I have a little treat for you because I was reading this and I was wondering, people always talk about Will Wheaton reading these audiobooks. And so I was like, what on earth did he do for this?
Yes.
So I tracked it down and I have a little clip that I want to share with everybody.
I'm excited. All right. Let's should we just cue it up?
Yeah.
All right. Here it comes.
1994, Star Wars TIE Fighter, Wing Commander 3, Doom 2. 1994, The Puppet Masters, Stargate. 1995, Absolute Zero, Shockwave, Wing Commander 4.
Uh-huh.
1996, Marine Doom, Doom 2, modified for use by the USMC. 1996, Star Trek First Contact, Independence Day. 1997, Men in Black, Starship Troopers, Contact. 1997, Independence Day video game tie-in released, PlayStation and PC.
Ah, yes.
God. Can you imagine if you were an over-the-road trucker and you accidentally, like, here, take this with you, and you pop that in. You're like, man, I've been on the road for quite a while. I need something to really perk me up.
Right. Trucker falls asleep at wheel and crashes into school bus. So that goes on for 5 minutes and 55 seconds of audiobook time.
The list does?
Yeah, it starts like that.
Wow.
He reads it in that tone, and like you said, no editorializing. It's incredible.
Wow, that is amazing. Because I mean,
it's like the opposite of Krusty the Clown coming in and out in 10 seconds.
Because Ready Player One was larded up pretty heavily with that too, and Will Wheaton read that. I assume it's the same deal.
Yeah, the scoreboards, I guess, or just the main list of all the directors he liked and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Wow, that is incredible.
But yeah, so he reads through that spellbinding chronology, and then he sort of gets into a little bit of like actual urban legends that he sort of tries to tie into what I guess is going to be the plot here of Activision sending you a patch if you had a high score, and this Polybius machine, which is, you know, something that I've heard about, but only in hearing about the urban legend of it. Like, it was never something that I heard about, but it's sort of like Dan Brown turf of being like, oh, well, like, here's what this symbolism in the Mona Lisa could have meant about the Knights Templar type of thing, like real life things that are obviously bullshit, but they're sort of giving it a little bit of real life credence.
Yeah, I think he asks a lot of, well, maybe he's just asking a lot of me, my style of reader, where I'm like, I've never heard of this before. So if this is a real thing, you know what I mean? I can't discern between what's real. You know, is it
right?
Sobra Kai glaive? Is that a real? I don't know anymore.
Right.
I don't care anymore.
Right.
And so, when this comes along as a major plot point, and then he's like, he describes it, and I'm like, oh, this is the thing. So this is the conspiracy. No, that's a real conspiracy. It was debunked,
right,
of course.
Right?
So once again, the Klein tension thing. Like, all right, oh, okay. So it's some conspiracy where they get people to. Nope, it's not.
Right.
But obviously it is going to be again, but
yes,
you know,
yes.
But I mean,
but he finds this, the journal that he says has lists of names, dates, movie titles, and half form theories scribbled across every page. And my reaction was just, well, then he goes on to publish these scribblings under the pen name Ernest Klein, and then, makes millions of dollars. But he talks about, these three movies, Ender's Game, Iron Eagle.
Yes.
Iron Eagle, which he describes, had instantly become one of his go-to pleasures, which I don't know too many 10-year-olds that have guilty pleasures. They're just, they don't have the discernment to have that sort of difference between a good movie and a bad movie. But anyway, and then The Last Starfighter, which we talked about last time, which I think he's just going to pretty much be parroting the plots of those, which are someone is good at video games and is then recruited by the government.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, by the way, before we skip over it, I want to go back to something because he mentions it again here, and I had a question about it. His mother, she had revealed some detail about, that he was conceived in the back of the crappy car, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he says she revealed it after one too many back-to-back viewings of Say Anything, which made me one too many back-to-back viewings, so she watched it at least four times in a row, I guess. I mean, the back-to-back viewings could happen, and then there could be space between them, but it's sort of implying that she's watching it back-to-back in a number of times in a row.
Right, yeah. You wouldn't say one too many drinks, and then you'd be like, oh, yeah, she had one drink every day for, you know, for a year. Like, it would be like she had one too many, she had five, and then she blurted that information out.
Right. So I'm you know, if you say like a few or one too many, it probably means at least three. So she was watching Say Anything at least six times.
Nonstop. Wow.
Six times. Because he talks about repeated viewings of Iron Eagle, but doesn't say whether, you know, he sometimes took in one too many back-to-back viewings of it.
But the other detail about his mom I liked is that she puts on a Charlie Brown Christmas album every year That's where he got his online handle from. But she opts to not go with the Vince Guaraldi Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack. She opts to go with the Royal Guardsman's Snoopy versus the Red Baron album, which is like a novelty song that it does have a song called Snoopy's Christmas, which is a sequel to that song. I looked it up, but it's, you know, that would be like, I don't even know what the, you know, oh, I watch that movie, A Christmas Story, every year. The remake where Daniel Stern is the dad. That's what I mean when I say I watch A Christmas Story every year. I watch the direct-to-video sequel from 2010.
Hey, honey, it's Christmas. It's time to watch our favorite Jimmy Stewart movie. So, Winchester 73? Exactly.
So that just, from a minutia perspective, that tickled me.
Yeah.
And then something else that someone wrote in about was that his dad is saying that his conspiracy theory, to lay it out, is that the government is in control of the entire video game industry.
Yes.
So then they've made some of these games to train people to fight, like Doom and Asteroids or whatever. But a woman named Janelle wrote in and said, so they're in control of the entire video game industry. So that means they're producing stuff like Mario in Time or Donkey Kong Jr. The government is tentacles are overseeing all these things. So they're like, yeah, make the ones to train the guys. Yeah. But like, what the hell are the people doing that are working on A Boy and His Blob? Like, we need some reports right from that department, and we need the guys making Conker's Bad Fur Day to weigh in. Like
Earthworm Jim. Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Like, we don't need any messages in there, but like, we want it to be, you know, acclaimed and, you know, sort of revolutionize the control scheme on the, Super Nintendo controller.
Right.
So they were like, they oversaw the failure of the Atari Jaguar. You know, they were like, you know, we need Sega to cash in on, anyway, there's all sorts of things you could.
Yeah. Their production of the Dreamcast. I really had high hopes for.
Yes. Right. But the government authorized the game named Seaman. They were like, all right, well, that was stupid. That was clearly going to be very unappealing to people. Anyway, so that was a, you know, well, if you're taking them at face value, you've got to assume that these things are true.
Yeah.
So do you have anything else about chapter two?
I have a couple of nitpicks. He talks about his mother giving him the stories and said that she was a trooper, and that's a typo. He said T-R-O-O-P-E-R. Trooper is, of course, T-R-O-U-P-E-R.
Okay.
And again, I said it's a nitpick. The other thing he said was his starry-eyed, he had the same starry-eyed wanderlust that had triggered my glaive fighter hallucination. Wanderlust? Don't think he knows what the word wanderlust means. He has the desire to travel because he saw the glaives. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. He obviously just doesn't know what it means.
Yes, exactly. It's a I noted earlier that he said he had spent hundreds of hours just looking out at the distant horizon, which is a life well lived, sir.
Hundreds
of hours.
Yeah, that could have been that's wonder years time just going to waste, buddy.
Let's go to chapter three, but before we do that, I have a plug, Mike.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm excited.
The Blue Apron is revolutionizing. I'm just kidding.
And it comes in a box the size of a mini fridge.
But no one has actually said this, but people are probably wondering, you know, why don't you put your money where your mouth is, because you talk about how terrible these guys' books are for, hours at a time. And so I've taken those imaginary criticisms to heart, and maybe by the time you hear this, but next week on February 7th, I'm releasing a novel that people will be able to buy and read. And I would encourage you to do so if you are a fan of this podcast, or if you would like to read something that's more entertaining than the books we've been talking to you about.
Fantastic. Tell us about this book. Wait, first of all, how many books have you published?
So this is my second novel. I have put out two other books that were sort of coffee table books about Wikipedia, bad Wikipedia writing. Me and Josh Frullinger, the comics curmudgeon, did those.
Right. Picked those up. Very funny.
Wrote the foreword to the second one, which is also very funny. It's a very weird niche interest, but it's provided us a lot of delight over the years.
It is. It's great to pick it up and find something very funny. And something to pass around to the whole family. And and then your first novel.
The first novel was called Gone Whalin'. It was an absurd. They're comedy from the first part, but it was a book about a kid who starts waking up every other day on a 18th century whaling ship, and the problems that causes his college life, and he has to balance the two between surviving on the whaling ship and navigating the treacherous world of being a junior in college.
And you wrote this book and you never read Moby Dick or 2 Years Before the Mast. Is that correct?
A lot of people pointed out that there were numerous inaccuracies about the whaling life that I portrayed, which, I was upfront about that I was not going to be doing any research. When I did that book, when I watched that movie with Thor in it, The Heart of the Sea, that was sort of the real life story of Moby Dick, I was sort of impressed by how wrong I had got some of that stuff. But, if you're time traveling and viewing the person's life by looking into his ear while he's unconscious, I would hope that you've suspended disbelief enough to.
You weren't writing Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. Yeah.
But then, so the new one is called The Pole Vault Championship of the Entire Universe. And it is a deathly serious tome about a Holocaust survivor. And it's about a high school girl who she has believed her whole life that her grandfather is dead, but it turns out that he's not. And he has, in fact, founded his own micronation, which is a thing people do when they're crazy. They found a little parcel of land and declare it sovereign. And he has managed to be hosting the Olympics there in a matter of days. And so he recruits her to accompany him to the Olympics. And everything is proceeding as normal when the aliens show up.
Parallel.
It'll be out. I think you can certainly pre-order it right now, and you can read it next Wednesday.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me plug that.
Connor is a very funny writer. I urge you all to pick it up. I assume can we guarantee a laugh on every page, or can we guarantee a laugh in every paragraph? What have you settled on?
Oh, man. I went for every page, and I sort of tried to make it in paragraphs just because, that's the main focus. But we'll see. I think every page is certainly you can do, and hopefully it will make you laugh out loud.
That is a laugh bargain, people. So pick it up.
Not a guarantee.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. That's very exciting. It's always
thanks. Yeah, it should be cool. I'll send you a copy.
Great. I'm looking forward to it.
It was sort of like I started writing it before we had done all this. So there is a whole major subplot involving Riggs and listing my favorite things from 80s pop culture, which in retrospect, it's embarrassing.
You might have left yourself open to some charges of hypocrisy. Physician, heal thyself. We'll see.
There's a part where one of the aliens just quotes the Goonies for 3 pages straight, and that's, I don't know, people might seize on that, but we'll see.
I think you put a fresh twist on it. We'll see.
But yeah, so as we move on with Armada, he enters into the third chapter, which is his work life. He's late for work, and he shows up at this sort of strip mall where he works at a video game store, which is next to a Thai restaurant.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Because this ties into something I wrote down. This is one paragraph, maybe one and a half short paragraphs. Here are the phrases that you get, and after that you can... This will be clear when I read it. One short paragraph contained these phrases: Starship Captains, TIE Fighters, Star Trek, Enterprise, Turbo Lasers, Overclocked Gaming PC, and ended with, Dost Thou Care for a Funyun?
It's like a Harlem Globetrotters routine where they end with a spectacular alley-oop.
Yeah, so, yep, the Thai restaurant called Thai has turned into they call it the TIE Fighter. And they call it that because they said that the H bows out and looks like a TIE Fighter?
If I told you that there was a Thai restaurant that I had nicknamed TIE Fighter, you would say, oh, yep, little clever wordplay. But he has to go and add on this absurd image that makes it, I don't even know what he's talking about, and I know what a TIE Fighter looks like, but they have crafted their restaurant sign so the capital H had a circular bulge at its center that made the letter resemble an Imperial fighter with twin ion engines. And I guess that's just in case you didn't get it, like he's sort of doing the Mr. Miyagi thing we talked about earlier.
But this is after he had explained that the place that he works is a video game store. They sell I mean, it's just like any mall video game store, right? Except the, what was the facade? He said his boss had sunk a fortune into the facade of the thing. And the place gets like one or two customers a day. They yeah. pretty much admit later. He said, it sure did look cool, but he'd sunk a fortune into it.
Into his strip mall awning?
Yes. So I just was like, okay, so it's going to be this eccentric, independently wealthy dude when we meet him. And I'm like, no, it's the traditional slobby video game player. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so he's running a Kevin Smith Clerks / Androids Dungeon from The Simpsons kind of store, where he walks in and the Star Trek noise of the whooshing doors still made me smile every time I arrived at work, which I thought was just like, because I'm an easily amused simpleton.
Every time. So yeah. So like setting your error message on your early PC to dope, exactly. dope. Yes. It amused me every time.
He walks in from work, like, the day that his ex-girlfriend had dumped him for that wrestler, just feeling like down in the earth. He wants to leap off his roof, and then it whooshes and he's like, ah. Yeah. But yeah, his boss, who offers him Dost Diet Want a Funyun, my lord, says that Ray seemed to subsist primarily on a diet of high fructose junk food and old video games. It was hard not to love the guy.
Apparently the only one on the planet who feels that way about this guy.
Yes, because he's an idiot. He puts everything on sale all the time. He has earned all his money in the dot-com boom, so he just evidently can waste it here. But he frequently berates children to the point where he's driving them from the store with his opinions on crop circles and cheat codes. So that's a cool thing to do to children.
Yeah, I think we've all had a barber or something that we've really enjoyed hearing his theories on the gold standard or whatever. That's like, children love that.
Exactly. You berate someone about quantitative easing to the point where they're like, I will pay a guy on the street to cut my hair rather than have to listen to this anymore.
Yeah, your haircuts are inexpensive. They're comfortable. I love what you do. And yet I'm out of here, man.
I was reminded of when the catchphrase, when August and George bought the orange box.
However
many years ago, I for whatever reason, that's something I remember, where the clerk who they purchased it from was like, that is a lot of game, man.
Yeah. He like, before they could take it out of his hand, he sort of gripped it a little tighter and made sure to look in their eyes and say, you're getting a lot of game on this baby.
we're aware. We want to purchase it. We're aware of what it contains. Yeah. It's a primary. Yeah. The value for the amount of hours we're going to get is a primary driver here.
I want you to come back in next week and tell me if I was wrong about that. Yes. If you don't, I got your number right here. I'm going to call you.
So he is playing Terra Firma, which is the bizarrely segmented cousin to Armada. We've yet to meet Armada, but we know that there are two games, the land and the sea, land and the air version. And he goes through a very long description of it. The one thing that I took away from that was that in Terra Firma, in the video game, you are controlling drones for this warfare.
Yes.
Which was a bizarre sort of fourth wall to put in there. So you, on a video game, you log in and then you're controlling a fake thing in general.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had no idea why they needed to put that extra step in there.
I think it probably sets up a thing that later he's going to go, obviously, he's going to go old school and he's going to get inside the thing. Yeah. Cause he spent a chapter. Look, it was very, very hard to keep my eyes open during this. This chapter was unbelievable. I wrote down, I know it's not a department that we do on the show, but I'd like to at least nominate something. I don't think it's probably good for our listenership, but the most boring sentence of the week.
This is not, oh, wow.
Yeah, this is not something we want to call out necessarily.
I don't know. Yeah.
But he gets his boss gives him a controller at some point, which the description of is just like, you cannot keep your eyes open. But this is after that. He says, Chaos Terrain manufactured a wide variety of Terra Firma controllers, including the best-selling Titan Control System, a dual flight stick rig that we sold right here in the store. All right. He's just giving us other models of flight sticks. He's just describing right. them Inventory. And talking about. And by the way, if you did need to buy one, we do carry them here in the store. Like, it's a fictional store. I can't go buy it. I'm not looking for inventory right now. I don't really need a report. Right. I'll go to Amazon if I need. I don't know. What?
Yeah, it was a it took a long time, but they finally were unable to resist describing a rig in great detail. And I was amazed at the sensual nature of some of the things. It has a hands-on throttle and stick. It's got 8-way studs. It's a sensual rig.
I was really struck by the innovation of in RP1, obviously lots and lots of descriptions of him playing video games. But this was a very long chapter of him watching his rude, repulsive, Funyun-eating boss playing video games. Yes. And then that was followed shortly by an unboxing. Yes. They like unbox a thing and they just describe it.
Right.
Wow.
It is a transcription of a unboxing video, which is a brand new turf in unnecessary, boring descriptions.
But that was after he's literally just sitting over his shoulder watching him play a video game, and he's describing it.
And he's watching one of he's watching by far the best Terra Firma player I've ever seen in person. He is watching a member of the 30 dozen, an elite guild, who devotes every waking hour to his missions. And so naturally, we watch him immediately get his ass kicked and fail, and Newark is leveled yes. because of his incompetence, which is just a great Kleinian touch.
I also noted that after he gave him the controller, like he showed him the controller and then said, you know, he's like, yeah, but I could never afford it. And he actually talks about like thrusting his hands in his pockets and like kicking the floor like he's one of the... He's a Katzenjammer kid or something.
Yeah. I don't know.
And then he's like, oh, you like it, huh? And he pushes it back towards him. Consider it a graduation gift. And he's like, oh, boy, do you mean it? Oh, gee. And he yeah. like gives the guy a hug, which I assume like covered right. him in Funyun dust and everything.
Run home, Charlie, and don't stop to anyone along the way.
It was a very odd moment in the middle of this thing. It just, again, his tone, he has no control over his own tone.
Right. Yeah. The one thing he does have control of is the ability to needlessly insert Rush into his
things. Ah, yes, Rush is back.
Delightful. And to his credit, like he likes this. He likes Rush, and so he's wedging them in. But it starts. I thought it was sort of like a really shitty director cameo, like when Quentin Tarantino used to put himself in all his movies, or M. Night Shyamalan, where it's like, I guess you're in charge and you're calling the shots, so you can do this incredibly self-indulgent thing, but it doesn't make you look good, man. Like, we know you want to do it, and you know, it's right. just there because you like it, but it's a weird thing to just wedge in there.
Yeah, he had a lot of actual names that he mentioned, especially game designers, and I wonder how they felt about that. Like, hey, don't drag me into this, man.
Yeah.
Because he makes up his fictional game designer, but then in order so that you get it, he's like, then he recruited others like blah, 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 you know, and actual guys who I don't know who they are, but I assume they're real game designers. Otherwise, it would just be another list. And I just wonder how they feel about that. Like, keep me out of this.
Yeah, a reader named Jordan Rohrer wrote in and sort of pinpointed like each one of those. Like, this guy is an animation studio head. This guy runs Valve, who hasn't shipped a game since 2003. Shigeru Miyamoto is a Nintendo producer. None of these people would leave to take this gig, and none of them work on this type of project. It's just sort of like it's like your dream team, I guess. If you were making a band, like, you could get the best musicians who didn't necessarily work together well, but, you know, they're the best at all of what they do, you know. Right. I'd have Steve Vai, and then I'd have, you know, that jazz drummer who's, you know, the alcoholic guy who berates his band type of thing. I don't know any famous jazz drummers. But anyway, what else happened here? The other one that I took note of was he said the game's backstory embraced a lot of tired alien invasion tropes, which, again, is a how dare you moment to our author here.
Well, he's actually, that's what he's going to be using in the book. It's not only things that he's done in the past or that he's leaned on. That's going to be the plot, I assume, is going to be nothing but a tired alien invasion trope. So I was puzzled by why he did that. How's he going to get himself out of his own noose?
It's very, yeah, from everything that I have gathered about this, it's pretty much the plot to The Last Starfighter, which I watched the trailer of, and I'm not going to watch the movie. I think that my time to appreciate that movie has probably passed. But it's I keep thinking of this quote stuck with me for some reason. But when Roger Ebert reviewed Office Space, he talked about how they, you know, their little scheme to shave off the pennies. They like acknowledge that it came from Superman 3, which he was like, you know, a dumb movie would pretend this hadn't happened. But a smart movie, you know, acknowledges that this is where these guys would have heard about this type of scheme.
Right.
And so it's like, I guess, you know, sure. In that one little dose, it's smart. But when you're just like, yeah, this is exactly like the whole plot of The Last Starfighter, it doesn't make you seem smart in that situation. It's just sort of like, you know, Klein is always saying, like, no one in a zombie movie has ever seen a zombie movie before. But this is different than that, I think. It's just as wholesale.
Yeah, because he does it many times. Like, he does it in small ways and large. When he did the – he was describing some creature in the game, which, again, I my eyes were half-lidded at that point. But he described a creature that he was fighting and said, it's the Terminator with his skin off. With a globe on his head or something. That was it. Yeah. Like, he's no, it, just picture that. That's all you need to do. I don't want to get to the down and dirty about describing a thing. Just is it the Terminator? So yeah, that's his stock and trade.
Buddy Rich was the jazz drummer. Isn't he the Guys Get Shirts guy?
No, that's the Guys Get Shirts is Paul Anka.
Oh, damn it.
But yeah, I think Buddy Rich has that reputation. I was telling somebody about James Brown and his technique on stage. Did you know that you can see it in live concerts, which are on film and everything, of him? He'll be singing, he'll be vamping, and then he'll say something that sounds incomprehensible, and he'll point back to the band. And what he's saying is, I just deducted $50 from you because you just screwed up. And this is like concerts are peppered with that. And then you watch the guy, you'll see the reaction of the guy. He'll be like, oh, man.
Wow.
Yeah. He would just do it live all the time, like, and signal to them that they just blew it. Instead of like the after band meeting, like occurred during the concert, apparently.
Yeah, it's like a wrestling coach giving out burpees or something. It's I always heard that he fined his band, but I never really thought about the process of how it would have worked.
Yeah, he did it live.
Well, I think that's what I've got for there. Do you have anything else from the game store?
I just have, let's see, a couple of things to dust up, and then I'll save. I have runners up to Dumb Sentence of the Week.
Okay.
But then I have my actual one. Here was just one little odds and ends. The name of the game designer, did that stick out to you? I didn't look it up, I didn't see anything that it referenced.
Who was it?
Finn Arbogast, which I thought was getting very Lucas-y on us there.
Yeah, wow, well, yeah, definitely.
Finn Arbogast, and I assumed that was like the name of a game, but no hits came up when I put it in. It was just references to Armada, so I don't know what it means, but it just sounded really dumb and unnecessary.
Yeah, that's very Lucasian.
Yes. So that's it. So what we're left with the story so far is he sees an alien and he goes to work. I mean, right? I guess he once again rooted through his father's mad ravings, but that didn't really reveal much other than that his father also was sort of insane.
Yeah, or his father is maybe has been recruited to this, and that's why he mysteriously disappeared in that absurd thing. You know, we all know where this is going. It just is like this point we needed to get there. That's the first 50 pages. That and 5 minutes 55 seconds of reading a list of movies that came out.
Yeah. So that's your guess, is that his dad was recruited out of the wastewater treatment plant into the military, and he's going to be still alive.
I would like nothing more to be proven wrong, and that his dad's body is like still unrecoverable, like in, you know, the pile of sewage at the waste treatment plant.
He's mummified in feces.
Yeah, he's like caught halfway through a filter in the that's supposed to keep him out, and they just haven't been able to get down there and get it because it would involve shutting off the city's water for like 24 hours. But yes, I think that's my prediction.
By the way, this is unrelated to any – well, it's related, but my father, for a time when I was a youth – He worked at wastewater treatment plants. He was part of the city water team.
Oh, wow.
And so as a kid, I used to go through the wastewater treatment, and we'd walk out on the big things where the raw sewage came in, and then it was treated, okay. And then in the next, and there was like a little dock that you walked through, you know, many, many gallons of human waste. And when you got to the end, it was like, hey, it's starting to smell pretty good down here. and then fresh water came out the other side. So
wow.
As a kid, it was pretty cool to walk across a gigantic lake of poop. And then
yeah,
to
no
the
kidding.
End of it, it was pretty nice.
That makes how the sausage is made look like a candy factory or something.
Yes.
Well, yeah, let's get to the dumb sentence of the week.
Here it comes.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period or an exclamation or a question mark. A sentence always ends.
Okay, I think I'm clear on what a sentence is. Let's see if Ernest Cline is.
Yeah.
Dumb well, sentence some... of the week. What do you have for us?
We've got some nominations from people who wrote in. We got a ton of emails this week, more than any other week, I would say. So thanks for sending those in. We've covered a few of them. People wrote in about the conglomeration of video game designers. Someone had nominated the one about Ozzy screaming all aboard. A guy named Kevin Loria said the one about Excalibur, as depicted in the film of the same name, was his nomination. But mm-hmm. one we didn't cover was David Kaysen wrote in and said, maybe the memory of my father's conspiracy theory had been sitting up in a forgotten corner of my brain all these years, like a discarded crate of dynamite sticks, sweating drops of nitroglycerin onto my subconscious.
that's pretty
maybe
good.
That had happened.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I would describe that as. So that's a bizarre thing that, you know, stick to the 80s references. Don't try to get too abstract here, which is related to my nomination for Dumb Sentence of the Week.
Connor, what is your dumb sentence of the week, please?
Very early on, and yes, this is one sentence. Seeing that glaive fighter, or imagining I'd seen it, had triggered a small rock slide in my mind that was already growing into a crushing avalanche of conflicting emotions and fragmented memories, all of them linked to my father and that old journal I'd found among his things.
Wow.
So seeing it or imagining I'd seen it had triggered a rock slide that was already growing into a crushing avalanche, an avalanche of emotions and memories. Which National Novel Writing Month novel, like, you know, maybe you bang that out one night trying to hit your 2,000 words, and then you look at it the next day and like, what was I thinking? Like, just delete the whole thing. Like,
no, I bet that and the nitroglycerin thing, he's kind of like, all right. There, you said you wanted something besides.
Images.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have a couple, and I guess I'll read my. All right. I'll read them in this order, and then my final one. The first one is a simple one. If I had been a cartoon character, my eyes would have bulged out of their sockets. Yep. If you had, I guess so. That is true.
That's one sure.
One way to describe. That just struck me as stupid. All right. Dumb sentence of the week, too. My father's sketch of its cabinet was far more elaborate and detailed than his sketch of Polybius, perhaps because he'd claimed to have seen the game with his own eyes. Across the top of the page, he'd written, I saw this game with my own eyes. That's very Kleinian. I just thought that was not the best example of Kleinian, but it's a very good one.
Tell them what you're going to tell them and then tell them.
Yeah, immediately tell them.
Yes.
Don't wait a second. All right, and here's my dumb sentence of the week, and this ties into something we've already talked about. It's a slightly longer. When the Star Trek door chime sounded a few minutes later and a gaggle of semi-regulars from the nearby junior high filed into the store, I shoved my new helmet, throttle, and flight stick controllers back into their box and stowed it under the counter before any of the prepubescent hooligans could lay their covetous eyes upon it. Again, he's an old man from a cartoon from the 30s.
Right.
He's prepubescent hooligans.
He's shaking his fist. And
yes. Yeah.
Go on, scram.
Scram, you. I'm just sore is all.
Oh, well, he does not fail to deliver on that front. I'm in favor of trying to find the boring sentence. I'm, you know, I don't know if we're going to find as good a theme song, but let's
yeah,
keep
let's
them coming,
look,
folks.
Let's look that up. Yeah, it is fun to, when you take them in isolation, it is fun.
Right.
So I don't think
will
be boring. So
No.
Yeah.
It will be delightful. Well, let's do just a few emails.
We're going to the party. We're going to the game. We're going to the disco. We're going to cruise out, man.
Yes, let's steal some people's mail. What do you got for us, Connor?
All right, I've got four emails, and let's see if you can detect the theme that's going to emerge. Balaji Sarpeshkar writes in, says, just a few chapters in, and I want to throw this book off a cliff. Glad I got it from the library and didn't pay for it. Paul Kuhn writes in, P.S., if Rush and their songs that are somehow perfectly timed for alien fighting are actually part of the conspiracy, I'm going to throw this book out the nearest window. Janelle writes in and says, I haven't felt a real need to chuck the book across the room, but then again, it's only been 47 pages. And then Vanessa submitted a comic on Twitter where she is, in the first panel, she is reading on her phone a section that comes later that says, my mother was also ridiculously beautiful. I know people are supposed to say things like that about their mothers, but in my case, it happened to be fact. Few young men know the Oedipal torment. And in the second panel, it is her throwing her phone to the foot of her bed. So
well,
this is a common reaction, evidently.
Well, can I go back to a note I just skipped over because we jump back and forth. But it is written down. I can guarantee it. The argument between the two mics was an early toss the book across the room moment. I really thought I'd prepared myself better than that with one of my notes. So, yeah, we're on to something.
Yeah, the argument between the two mics was just
we neglected it was pretty special.
My favorite part of that was he says, ever since grade school, I had been calling them by their last names to avoid confusion. The mics were still engaged in there.
One
more person wrote in, Nathan Dustman said, the way Ernest Cline delves deep into inane details about 80s subcultures reminds me of a no-talent version of Tom Clancy, who uses a book to brag about how good he is about researching technical information about military equipment, which turns out to have zero impact on the plot. The key difference between the two is that Clancy understands sentence structure and is quite capable of describing a developing storyline. So,
that is true. I've abandoned. I think I've only tried Clancy once. I did abandon him when it was like a 3-page description of a missile system. You know,
right? So. Well, that's what I thought when I tried to read one of those Master and Commander books. I was like, I don't even know what the words he's using to describe the boats mean. So it's just too much for me.
Yeah. Well, then you won't like 2 years before the mast.
Mast, I understand. Well, yeah, so that's mail. Please send them all in. We look at Twitter and Facebook too. A lot of people are commenting on those, so that's been a lot of fun. Send us your dumb sentences of the week. Send us your boring sentences of the week. Send us your fan fiction. Good Lord.
We have a lot of assignments for our listeners.
Because
they also have to read.
Yeah, read this. Oh, God, I didn't even look up what that was going to be.
Oh, yeah, we need
while I
the
look that up. Let's arbitrarily decide that right now.
Oh, okay. It's going to happen live, people. Connor, I can see him right now. He's
flop sweat.
He's picking up his coffee cup. He's trying to get energy.
Let's read up until phase two. Phase two, which starts with everyone's favorite quote from everyone's favorite book for a dive bar bouncer to be reading, Sun Tzu. All war is deception. Phase two kicks in on right after page 95, I guess.
By the way, I was once my flight got canceled and I had to be crammed into a plane, into a tiny plane to get home. And right next to me, a guy who was spilling over into my seat was I assume was a bodybuilder. And he had, the gun show was on. And he was in my, and he was sitting with Sun Tzu and then, like a nudie magazine. And he was just, he couldn't be more proud of both of those things. And,
wow.
And so and his arm was draped over mine and there was no way to avoid watching him sit there and pretend to read Sun Tzu.
That would have been the most viral photo of all time if you had been in this era.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's the show, right? We got the
Yeah. So, thanks for joining us. We've got the assignments and, thanks for listening.
Yeah, we'll see you next time on 372 pages. We'll never get back. Armada edition.
Armada. Big time. Buy my book.